for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The unemployment rate fell to 10% in November, down from 10.2% in October. Yesterday, the White House held a summit on ways to spur job growth. A Gallup poll shows 51% of Americans support President Obama's new plan for Afghanistan. And the Senate backed preventative health screening for women in one of its first votes on amendments to the health care bill. Joining me in the studio for our Friday News Roundup, Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard, Melinda Henneberger of PoliticsDaily.com, and David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. Of course, we welcome your comments this morning. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, you can also reach us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
And welcome to you, Melinda.
Thank you.
So glad to have you here. David Korn, the Labor Department jobs report better than expected. What's happening? Is the stimulus working? What's your theory?
Well, you know, there's a drop of 0.2% in the official unemployment rate. That's not a lot, but it beats a rise of 0.2% or greater.
And in terms of numbers, rather than the 130,000 expected, it's 11,000.
11,000 people have lost their jobs in the last month. So it does seem to be, you know, slowing down the economic downturn. And this week, as Barack Obama has held his jobs summit and has seemed to steer the White House more towards focusing on unemployment, you've had Republicans out there saying, where are the jobs, and dismissing his efforts. But yet, at the same time, the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan research outfit that everybody genuflects to in this town, put out a report saying that in the third quarter of this year, GDP growth, I think 0.6 to 1.6% or so, maybe higher, 2, 3%, could be attributed to the stimulus, and that the stimulus saved or created 600,000 to 1.6 million jobs. So by that account, and it's really the most authoritative account we have, the stimulus spending that, you know, that was passed earlier in the year, $787 billion, only half of which has been spent, has kicked in and has, you know, raised the economy. The big question for Obama, of course, is, you know, since he's now loath, it seems, to do that again, what can you do policy-wise from the top of Washington to get the economy to produce jobs that will be high-paying jobs and stick around for a long time?
David Korn, he's Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. Matthew Continetti, do you have a different take on this?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans were kind of hopeful, looking forward to the midterm elections, thinking that they could ride a high unemployment number to taking back one or maybe even in their wildest fantasies, both houses of Congress next year. But of course, now from the White House's perspective, that unemployment number is headed in the right direction. So Republicans are going to have to try to recalibrate and think maybe there's some other issues, if the job market continues to improve, that they're going to emphasize as they try to take back Congress.
But, Matt, the question becomes, is the stimulus working?
Well, based on certain assumptions that the CBO did and using the same models, which were similar in both the White House's arithmetic and the CBO's, and, yeah, you can say it saved or created, which is a great phrase because, you know, it's hard to tell which jobs are saved and which are not. The fact is the stimulus was very good in preventing a lot of government employees from getting laid off. And this is great because that means a lot of people have kept their jobs. In terms of actual job creation, David mentioned the big economic stimulus was the Cash for Clunkers program, which brought up all these car sales into the third quarter. But then as soon as it was over, we saw car sales plummet again. I think real sustained job growth, economic recovery, is going to come from the private sector, not government spending.
Matthew Continetti. He's associate editor of the Weekly Standard. Turning to you now, Melinda Hanneberger, what is your take on this new report?
Well, of course, it's great to hear that the loss of jobs has been slowed and that we seem to be heading in the right direction. But for people who are still feeling the crunch, that's not a lot of comfort. So, you know, when I was listening to the coverage yesterday of the job summit, one of the questions that Obama asked to these, I might say, executives who've had to lay off people themselves. So here he is looking for ideas about job creation from people who are laying off tens of thousands of their own workers. He was saying, what can we do to get people hiring again? And, you know, with credit as still as frozen as it is, there didn't seem to be an answer. And I think that's still worrying, as it should be for a lot of us.
There was some criticism about the organization and the content of that job summit. For example, the Chamber of Commerce was excluded. There were two Nobel Prize winners there, including Paul Krugman, but nobody on the conservative side, David.
You know what? It doesn't matter. The job summit doesn't really matter. I mean, it's a nice photo op. It shows that the president is thinking about this. But, you know, apropos Melinda's point, you know, there are some fundamental issues here in our economy. And, you know, we continue to have these jobless recoveries. What happens are these employers lay off a lot of workers and productivity actually goes up. They make the people who stay behind work harder and for not any more pay. And they get used to the fact, hey, this ain't so bad. We cut our labor costs. And what we need to do, and, you know, it's easy to say the private sector has to create more jobs. We need to figure out where we're going in terms of large industries, or at least, you know, a lot of small industries that can generate new jobs. And I think that's where government policy can sort of lead the way, whether it's by creating the next internet. You know, the green jobs focus is great. I think, you know, the president should continue to push that. And it's really these policy-driven things that create a little more opening, provide some seed money, is really our only hope. And, you know, summits, you know, good and bad. There was a silly Republican summit at the same time.
Why do you call it silly?
Well, they had all the people from the Bush years saying what we should do, exactly what we did during the Bush years. Well, the Bush years didn't leave us a great economy.
Well,
and they said we should cut back regulations when we had the biggest bubble that brought down a lot of the economy.
Matt Continetti, what Eric Cantor, the House Republican whip, talked about was cutting Washington regulations, cutting further federal taxes. It does sound like the Bush years from their point of view.
Right, right. And of course, you know, this is the Republican answer. You want a smaller government. You want to create conditions for markets to recover and the certainty for people to invest in the private sector. You know, the economists I look at, they're saying, listen, we need a lot of growth. Where does the growth come from? I don't think, and they don't think, I'm just parroting what they say, obviously, they don't think it comes from the government picking winners and losers. They think it comes from small business formation, individual entrepreneurs, people who are in their garages creating the next Amazon.com or Google, for example. We need to create the conditions for those new revolutionaries to create these great new industries. I don't think government can do it.
But they're talking about doing that by cutting taxes. Are they not?
Well, they are. And, you know, I happen to be skeptical of this. I think I think our tax rates are kind of about where, you know, if you cut them on the margins, it's hard to see more growth. That's what we saw during the Bush years, where once it gets below a certain level, that high marginal tax rate, you really can't cut it anymore.
Melinda.
Well, we've tested these theories. We've cut taxes and cut taxes, and we've seen the result of little to no regulation, and it wasn't pretty. So I don't see that this is being offered as a new proposition, whereas something that has not been tried is making incentives for a lot of new green jobs, and I really do think that that's something very promising.
Well, the president was talking about caulking and weatherizing.
Cash for caulkers.
Sounds goofy, exactly. But you know what? That's realistic. I mean, that's a very practical
weatherizing
thing.
Weatherizing people's homes.
Well, it's a double win. You get some people working. I'm not sure how many, and I'm not sure at what rate of pay, and then you save energy costs. You know, going back to Matt's point about Republicans in some ways are sitting rather pretty now. Even if unemployment dips to 9%, but stays above 9% or close to 10% for a whole year, there's going to be a lot of anger out there, and people are going to want to throw some of the bums out. The bums, you know, in that case will be Democrats because they hold power. So by being the default, you know, party of the minority, the Republicans are not in a bad position. But I do think they're hurting themselves by coming up with ridiculous ideas, by denying reality that the stimulus helped a little bit, by repeating old policies, and they'd be better off saying nothing than repeating the past.
All right, but meanwhile, Democrats are talking about creating new jobs by spending on roads, bridges, that kind of thing. Matthew, what's your thought there?
Well, one of my major criticisms of the stimulus was it didn't have enough of that infrastructure spending. I mean, it was weighted toward kind of basically, you know, government welfare programs, Medicare, Medicaid, those sorts of things to balance state budgets. So I would love to see more infrastructure spending. On the tax cut issue, I will say, to the Republicans' credit, in particular Mitt Romney, who had a kind of a battling op-ed with the president there in USA Today yesterday, he came across and came out for a payroll tax cut, which is, I think, an idea that's gathering a lot of momentum among a lot of conservative economists as a way to lower the cost of labor and spur job creation.
Matthew Connetti, he's associate editor of the Weekly Standard. He edits the magazine's Campaign Standard blog. You can join us. We'll take your calls after a very short break. Stay with us. Couple of more questions on the economy and on jobs. You can join us 800-433-8850. Yesterday, President Obama said it's not going to be possible for us to have a huge second stimulus because, frankly, we just don't have the money. How likely is it, Melinda, that he may call for more money by some other name?
See, that's so interesting to me that the stimulus, which, you know, stimulus traditionally has worked. So how did stimulus become so maligned? That's really a PR coup for the Republicans. So, yes, I think President Obama clearly will ask for stimulus by some other name because we have to have more spending to get the economy going again.
And is Bank of America's announcement that it's going to repay all of its federal aid significant in this whole discussion, Matthew?
I actually think it is, because it shows that the TARP, which was very good for the banks' balance sheets, right? So the TARP that was passed last year helped the banks stabilize, but what it didn't do is get them lending again. So now the banks are in this position. They're sitting on this money. They want to get rid of all the strings attached to the TARP money, so they're going to give it back. But at the same time, you still have this 10% unemployment number. And the reason, just to respond to Melinda for a second, the reason people don't think the stimulus worked was, let's not forget, unemployment is higher than the White House predicted had no stimulus been passed. So they're caught in this disjunction between rhetoric and reality when it comes to the stimulus.
All right. I'd like to open the phones now. We have questions on the economy. I want to get to those as quickly as possible. 800-433-8850. First to Stillwater, New Jersey. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
I'd like to ask why we keep hearing only half the stimulus money has been spent.
David Korn.
It takes a little time to spend hundreds of billions of dollars.
But
the money is going out. Some of this money is earmarked for particular, say, transportation projects in particular states, and the states go through bidding processes. And so, I mean, you can go to recovery.gov and other websites and actually track this stuff. As a journalist, that's what I do, looking to see where some of the money's going. And it's, you know, it's taking, you know, it was passed, you know, in late spring. It takes some time to get moving. So, but I return back to the CBO report that shows a real big punch in the third quarter, and I presume there'll be another big punch in the fourth quarter, and maybe even one in the next quarter of 2010.
Matthew.
Well, let's not forget Christy Romer, one of the administration's senior economists, said I think last month that really the stimulus had its biggest effect already, which surprised a lot of people here in Washington. And what they meant by that was that what you needed to get that initial push, that initial transfer of money to the states and such. And so I think that surprised a lot of people, being that this money hasn't been spent. Let's not forget, though, it's been scheduled to be spent later.
Right.
And that's something else to keep in mind. Again, as Republicans keep harping on this job number, they should keep in mind that as that stimulus money continues to go out, the job market may continue to improve, especially when it's this infrastructure money.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to Lynchburg, Virginia. Good morning, James.
Good morning. It seems to me that all these free trade agreements or that we have with other countries do only one thing, is they give free low-cost labor and deregulated production abilities to corporations who absolutely show no loyalty to this country at all. Couldn't we do away with some of the treaties like NAFTA or CAFTA or some of the GATT treaty?
I don't think it's going to happen, Melinda.
No, nor should it. I don't. I understand the impulse, but there is no turning back on free trade. I think that's pretty much what America is about.
All right. Let's turn to the president's plan for Afghanistan. Matthew, Senator Charles Schumer, number three in the Senate leadership, said he's going to weigh carefully President Obama's words. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Congress and the American people will fully examine the president's plan.
That's right. I thought it was a big moment for the president on Tuesday. For the first time in his presidency, really, he's taking on not only public opinion, he's taking on his own party. And so while Republicans, in my view, are focusing on that exit strategy he laid out and
right,
criticizing that, the real criticism is coming from Democrats. You know, in a Gallup poll prior to the speech, 6 out of 10, 60% of Democrats saying it's time to withdraw from Afghanistan. President Obama, on their hand, regardless of the exit language, is committing the United States, really the first Democratic president since Lyndon Johnson, to commit thousands, tens of thousands of Americans' troops to a foreign war. It's just a big moment in American history.
Well, that didn't work out so well, as we all know. I mean, it's true that he is up against his party. Lynn Sweet, reporting for Politics Daily the morning after, even the night of the speech, quoted Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, saying, well, I'll have to think about this. And Center for American Progress, it's a think tank here in town, run by John Podesta, who is a very close ally of the Obama White House, ran their transition campaign, put out a statement yesterday or the day before saying Congress needs to ask hard questions about Obama's
And
plan.
They certainly plan to. John Podesta was on this program the morning after the president made his statement.
But we can talk about the policy. I mean, I have a lot of a lot of skepticism about, you know, about the policy. But in terms of the politics, Obama is now claiming this war as his own, as the cliche goes, rushing into it without the support of his natural allies, the Democrats in Congress and the Democratic base. What does he have? He has the support of neoconservatives and conservatives who otherwise want to see his presidency fail.
Melinda.
Well, what I think is interesting, this really is a signature decision, I think, for his presidency, because, as David says, whatever you think about the decision itself, it's not so political. People said going in, the left is going to hate this, the right is never going to give him a break. You know, he could cure cancer and there would still be criticism. And yet, despite the fact that there was no natural constituency for this decision, Republicans and Democrats in equal number, according to the latest polling, actually supported him.
So you've got numerous congressional committees now looking into the decision. Can they do anything about it?
No, I don't think so.
Well, they can.
Well, there's the funding vote. I mean, we went through this over the Iraq surge. And, of course, what we saw there was a huge fight over money. Of course, then at the time, the Congress was controlled by the not the president's party. And then, of course, the debate grew even more heated once the troops arrived in theater, remember, in the summer 2007, and the fighting was bloody. And it will be the same in Afghanistan. That, I think, will be a real mark for Obama. How does he respond next year when all the troops are in theater and really taking out these Taliban strongholds?
On the political question, how does Vice President Biden come out on this decision? He had urged really against more troops.
Well, the next morning I got an email from the vice president, as I assumed did a couple million other people on the Barack Obama mailing list from the campaign, you know, highly supportive. I mean, obviously being a good soldier. I mean, this decision, you know, obviously seemed not to have been too political, but you had Obama facing a choice where you had the commander of the troops, Stanley McChrystal, saying, I need 40,000 troops. You had the ambassador there, Carl Eikenberry, who used to command the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, saying, we don't need more troops now. We got to make sure that we have a working government and a military here that could take advantage of the troops. And so, you know, what do you do in a situation like that when your polls apart and your vice president arguing, listen, a big counterinsurgency mission is not the way to go. We should be targeted against Al-Qaeda strongholds and Taliban packets, hitting them with drones, as the New York Times is reporting this morning. The drone program is expanding, and not worry about how to manage 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. So I assume that Biden's position remains the same, but, you know, he is very influential in these matters. He knows Pakistan, I think, better. I've actually talked to him about this than anybody else at the top of the administration. So he will be in there, I assume, advocating for making this work the best way he thinks
All
he
right.
can.
All right. Let's take a call from Jeff in Indianapolis. Good morning. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning. My question concerns the new Afghan plan and setting a timetable for leaving. Senator McCain and a lot of Republicans are saying if we set a deadline, the Al-Qaeda and Taliban will just stop fighting and lay low till we leave. And my question is, A, does anyone really think that they would actually stop fighting? And B, and I'd like to really ask this to John McCain, could someone explain to me why this would be a bad thing?
Melinda.
I've never before been asked to speak for John McCain, but, you know, he didn't really set a timetable. He set a goal. He is being pilloried by some on the left by saying, you know, this what was sold as a timetable isn't. And it's not so different from what former President Bush did, saying we're going to look at conditions on the ground and get out if it behooves us
but
to.
But he also said we would begin the exit,
right,
not wholesale withdrawal.
Gates, I think, said, or wasn't Gates Amon the other day, said, you know, it could take 3 to 5 years. I mean, I was on a background call with White House officials prior to the speech with other reporters, in which they said, you know, the date is for the beginning of an undetermined process,
right,
for an undetermined length of time of an undetermined slope. I mean, the time schedule. So it could be 3 to 5 years, and there's so much flexibility there. It's almost a meaningless number. It's more like a goal.
I agree with my esteemed panelists. I thought the key phrase in that speech was conditions on the ground. That's a conditions-based withdrawal. That's what McCain was calling for in Iraq in 2008.
So why did McCain single that phrase out?
Well, I think Republicans, sometimes they want to, you know, they're going to score political points, and I think they're being foolish. I think they should accept the policy for what it is, which I think it's a security-based measure to try to win the war in Afghanistan based on the recommendations of the commanders there, McChrystal and, of course, his boss Petraeus. You know, of course, Obama had to include that phrasing in there to placate his base, and he's in a political pickle. There's no question about it. The other key phrase, which emerged in the background call David alluded to, was population security. And what that means is they really are going to try to implement something similar to what happened in the surge in Iraq, where you go and your main goal, instead of these hit-and-run missions against terrorists, your main goal is to secure the population, and that leads to progress down the road. So those two phrases actually reassured me from my conservative point of view.
All right. And that's the voice of Matthew Continetti, the Weekly Standard. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's turn to healthcare. Where did things currently stand on the debate overhauling healthcare, Melinda?
Well, it's going to be tough to get the public option at this point. Harry Reid has said that, you know, they're still going to have something called the public option in the final bill. But at what point is a public option still, is that phrase meaningful?
Well,
you know, they've watered it down so much already that they can call it mac and cheese or they can call it anything, but is it really a public option? So now they're trying to find something that placates those who say they can't vote for anything with a public option in it and those who say that they will only vote for something with that in it.
Go ahead.
At the same time, this abortion issue is a huge stumbling block to getting a bill through. Now that Ben Nelson has said that he's going to introduce language that's very much like the Stupak amendment language from the House bill that says that no public money can be given to people who are being subsidized, whose health care is being subsidized even for private insurance that includes abortion coverage.
Isn't that overstepping some boundary, David?
Well, it's very much an extension of policy, which now is no federal money goes directly for funding abortions in all sorts of federal programs. And now what they're going to do is say if you as a private citizen go into this health exchange, get your own health care, and you get part of it subsidized by the government, you won't be able to buy any plan that has any abortion services in it. And what it's going to do, too, perhaps even more dramatically, it's going to force insurance providers to essentially take abortion out of all the plans they offer on the health exchange. Even if you come to buy it with your own dollars, no federal money, you won't be able to. You'll have to shop separately for an abortion plan. And abortion, by the way, it comes about through the lack of planning, so it's probably not going to be purchased by too many people. It's it's really the situation is
being exploited. I would think you've almost got a constitutional question going on here, Matthew.
Yeah, I mean, there are a variety of constitutional questions involved in the healthcare debate. And of course, I think David is right. I mean, what the Stupak language is supposed to do is apply the language of the Hyde Amendment, which is longstanding policy about no public funding for abortions, to these new healthcare exchanges, which are government run, and you have all these subsidies. And so, since money is fungible, the pro-lifers have the concern that, well, my tax dollars are going to enter in the exchange at one point, at the other end, come out and pay for an abortion. I actually think there are a variety of hurdles that this legislation faces. It's not just the public option. It's not just abortion. Others have to do with these Medicare cuts, I think, and also the financing issue. I think people haven't realized that Harry Reid's bill is very different in the manner in which it pays for the health care plan than Nancy Pelosi's bill. Pelosi, with the surcharge on millionaires, Reid with this tax on the payrolls and the Cadillac plans.
I want to ask you, Matthew, tell us about Senator Judd Gregg's memo on parliamentary weapons at Republicans' hands.
Right. Well, of course, in the Senate, the minorities have the minority party has a lot more power in order to derail legislation. So, of course, the Senate Republican leadership want to derail this bill. And they look at public opinion polls that show higher disapproval of the plan than approval, and they think public opinion is on their side. And so they're using these parliamentary tricks. You know, you can start the every day in the Senate is a new day, so you can issue a new rule. I think the important thing that happened this week, though, is we're finally getting votes on these amendments. And that started yesterday. The McCain amendment, which was going to strip the Medicare cuts from the bill, that failed. Whereas the Mikulski amendment, which it pays for free mammograms and other preventive screenings through the exchanges, that passed. And so I think it's important for the Senate Democratic leadership that the votes on these amendments are beginning.
Matthew Continetti, Melinda Hanneberger, and David Korn, they're all here to answer your questions. We'll open the phones again, take your email after we have a short break. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. International reaction to the shift in U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. Grenade and gun attacks on a mosque near Pakistan Army headquarters. And Iran plans to build 10 new nuclear plants. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We'll go right to the phones to Ocean Springs, Mississippi. Good morning, Steve. Welcome to the program. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Diane. We're talking, your conversation earlier focused on the economic outlook for the country and the employment numbers, I guess, over the next, which we're talking about, this current recession over the next year or two. And one of the primary principles and problems that I think we have in this country, what we've had at least the last 20, 30 years, is one of the concepts the Japanese said is that Japanese companies' short-term plan is 2 years in advance. American companies is two quarters. And the political process is the same way. I mean, your guests have already said that my party, the Republican Party, the party of no ideas, is intent on keeping the unemployment number high, obviously not in our national best interest for political purposes. And it seems everything now is done, even at the small micro level, for political purposes. And essentially, I think the reality of the situation, and you've had guests on the show that have talked about it before, we are a waning in a fallen economic power in the next 20 years, and I think your guests, if they speak candidly, will admit it, that our children and our future, we're going to have to learn to get by with less because we just don't have, apparently, the will, the desire, we're going to put forth the work effort to get ourselves out of this. We mirror almost identically the end of the British Empire, the end of the Roman Empire, the end of the Spanish Empire. We're making the same mistakes over and over
again. All right, Steve, that's a pretty broad indictment. Well, David?
Well, I feel his pessimism. I mean, I understand this point of view, and as a father of two young children, I think about it quite seriously. And I referred to it earlier when, you know, we put stimulus spending aside, where are the good jobs going to be coming from in the future? I think globalization, you know, it has to put pressure, downward pressure, on wages everywhere. And because the political pressure is such to have quick results by the next elections, it does make it hard for a president, a political party, whether you're in power or out of power, to think in long-term factors. And Obama has tried. He has said, you know, he doesn't say it much now, but in the beginning of his presidency, he said, this is a deep hole. It's going to take a long time. We have to be patient. If we can't be patient, we're going to we won't succeed.
Well, democracies have always had this tendency for short-term thinking for political considerations. Their jobs are up. I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think the good jobs are going to come from individual entrepreneurs. Who knows, the next Henry Ford's or Ray Kroc of McDonald's, they're going to come up with something. I have trust in that. The only question is, you can't saddle them with regulations and burdens on the cost of creating businesses.
All right, here's an email from Andy in Hillsborough, North Carolina. He says, it's tiresome to hear Republican mantras of cut taxes and deregulate. That's what gave us the recession and the large deficits. What needs to be done is to supply seed money for new jobs. At the same time, give money to the lowest level earners of the society, because that money is not saved but spent, which will stimulate the economy. Matthew.
Well, it's interesting because, in a way, the economic crisis has kind of restarted all these big debates about the proper role of government.
My
friends on the right used to always say, well, we've settled all those questions. We got government the right size. And, that, of course, they were saying that during the boom of the 1990s. And now we're having some real philosophical debates. I just happen to think, though, at the end of the day, government doesn't have a very good track record of picking winners and losers in the market. It's just, I think the evidence is there.
All right. I want to ask you all quickly about the Bernanke hearings yesterday. Senators were reacting in somewhat varied ways to Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, and even some calling for him to resign. One saying, I'm sorry you're even in this place to begin with. What do you think, Melinda? Is he going to get a second term?
Sure. He's in no real danger. I think a lot of that was theater. I think that many on the left are quite unhappy with him, and they needed to express that unhappiness and make that gesture. But Ben Bernanke is in no danger of not having a second, fourth term.
Matthew.
Four-year term.
Well, I think Melinda's right. There are 60 votes to confirm Ben Bernanke, you know, the hold Bernie Sanders of Vermont put on the nomination. What that means is that you need 60 senators to vote for confirmation. I think he has 60 votes. What I think will happen, though, even though as he retains his job, I think the Fed is going to come under much more scrutiny from Congress. You know, that there's that Ron Paul amendment out there that has hundreds of co-sponsors about auditing. It would audit the Fed. So all of its decision-making would now go be audited by congressional processes.
Thank goodness.
Chris Dodd also has an amendment out there that would change the way which the regional banks get their governors. Chris Dodd wants the central Fed here in D.C. to appoint the directors of the regional banks. Congress is going to start running the Fed, I think.
David.
Bernanke is too big to fail. I mean, that's just clearly they're not going to make the change. He was there at the, you know, for the crisis. People can judge for themselves whether he handled the crisis well or not. He's got a lot of attack for being too generous to the AIGs of the world. And I think it's a good move now. I think the Fed has been this temple that's been anti-democratic in small d terms, you know, for decades. It's, you know, it controls so much of our economy, or so influential upon our economy, and yet it has so few democratic controls. And like it or not, we're told we live in a democracy. So one of these provisions that we just talked about, subjecting the Fed to oversight, it would be the General Accounting Office, which has a tremendous nonpartisan record for decades here in this country of doing great reports that are called up by Republicans and Democrats that would be doing the auditing. I think that's at the, you know, at the very least, after what the Fed did under the Greenspan years and the Bernanke years, that's a starting position.
All right, let's go to Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, what I'd like to say is fairly concise. I've been asked to keep it concise. It would help if I could elaborate for a little, but I just simply won't until I'm given permission to. What I want to say very quickly is that this is not health care reform. This is more finance reform for corporations and the wealthy people who already have access to medical care.
What do you think, Melinda?
Well, I think that this bill is trying to do a lot of things. This bill is really trying to reform health care insurers, I want to say. You know, this is really trying to clamp down on an industry whose profits have skyrocketed and people aren't getting the care that they deserve. You know, I think that a large swath of Americans agree that people shouldn't lose their coverage mid-chemo, that people shouldn't should still be able to get insurance even if they have a pre-existing condition. So I think that there are a lot of things we can agree on that are going to come out of health care reform.
Matthew.
I think the caller raises an interesting point. There is a case to be made that the current health reforms are too friendly to the insurance companies. And what the caller is registering, to my ears anyway, is a sense of populistic discontent that is not limited to any one part of the ideological spectrum. That's what's also fascinating about the fight against Ben Bernanke and the Fed. You have left-wingers and right-wingers. You have the Chris Dodds and the Ron Pauls all coming together and voicing this popular discontent with institutions which are seen to favor the strong and not think about the weak.
You know, I'm interested in what happened in New York and Washington this week about same-sex marriage. New York Senate voted 38-24 against a gay marriage bill on Wednesday. The D.C. City Council voted overwhelmingly, 11-2, to approve it. So what's happening, David?
Well, some people might be surprised to learn that the New York State Senate, you know, is not a liberal body. And hasn't been, and traditionally it's where the Republicans in New York State have had most of their long-term power. So I think the majority, though, ended up being surprised. It was pretty decisive, 38-24. The D.C., you know, council is a much more liberal, tolerant body, and the you know, the gay community in Washington has been long a very active part of the political scene here. So it was not a surprise that Washington passed this, but it does seem, you know, from the 30,000 foot perspective, to make it seem as if the movement for gay marriage and for gay rights, you know, hit a bit of a speed bump in New York.
Melinda.
What was really interesting to me, and I listened to a lot of the speeches in the New York State Senate, was how the Republicans, who clearly some of them wanted to vote for it, felt cowed by the prospect of Sarah Palin swooping in, maybe not personally to their races, but they really did feel that in any other year and in another climate, they might have gone along with Democrats. They really couldn't do so. And there was a wonderful speech by a woman, State Senator Ruth Hassel Thompson, who was talking about her mom was a minister, her sister's a minister, she's grown up in the church, and she herself had an older brother who pretty much fled to France. Not that that's such a terrible thing to have to do, but who was really rejected by his whole family because he was gay.
And Matthew Continetti, as the author of The Persecution of Sarah Palin, what do you think is going on in these debates and in the New York vote versus the D.C. vote?
Well, Diane, for me, the important thing is this is all doing going about in the democratic process. It's not, I think, a big concern has always been that major decisions like these affecting social relations for the entire country would be imposed from above by judges. Instead, we're having debates at the, whether it's the referenda level or whether it's the elected body level, which is a democratic process. And I think over time, you are going to get gay marriage. It's going to take a long time, but it's going to be done through the democratic process, and therefore it will have, I think, more legitimacy, these laws, than if they were imposed from above.
All right. Let's go to Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Yeah. A year ago, the president-elect or the president campaigning said that we're in the worst economy since the Great Depression, and he knew exactly how to fix it. Well, as of yesterday, they were out trolling for ideas, almost as if they don't have a clue.
What do you think, Melinda?
Well, I don't recall candidate Obama saying he knew exactly how to fix it. That's a pretty tall order. People do tend to overstate the possible during a campaign. But it's not an easy thing to get us out of. You know, I think the part of what you said that's absolutely true is that he's standing around saying, knock on my door if you have a good idea.
Well, and clearly the problems were a lot bigger than he thought they were
right
when he got there. Melinda Henneberger is editor-in-chief of PoliticsDaily.com, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'd be interested in your reaction to the follow-up of what happened to the White House Party Crashers last week, Matthew.
You know, what's fascinating to me is that the story has provoked so much outrage of the Party Crashers. People, they're being attacked on The Daily Show and things like that. They may be subpoenaed to testify before Congress. But to me, it's all about we've now elevated our presidents to such a high level, and they live in this bubble. And when you penetrate that bubble, like the Party Crashers did, it becomes a scandal. I couldn't help thinking of one of my favorite presidents, Andrew Jackson. When he became inaugurated, of course, a mob descended on the Capitol, and he greeted them, and he was always available to them. Now we live in very different times.
Okay, but I don't think back then we had anthrax.
There are plenty of guns,
on a minute. Nobody has explained to me whether this couple was actually seated for dinner.
They were not.
Whether they were ushered out or whether they left on their own accord. Melinda.
I completely disagree with Matthew on this. I think if after closing off Pennsylvania Avenue to the great discomfort of most Washingtonians, after spending billions of dollars in two wars and many lives to make us safe from terrorists, what have the last 8 years been about if someone can stroll into the White House and shake hands with the president and isn't stopped by the Secret Service? So, that is scary and humiliating to all of us.
So was it the responsibility clearly and solely of the Secret Service, which did yesterday?
They have accepted responsibility.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it is their responsibility. You would think, you know, in years past, there has been a system where people from the social office were there checking people off as well, and that's a good backup. But nevertheless, I would, you know, I don't mean to cast aspersions on the Secret Service in general, but, you know, they should make sure if those people aren't showing up to do that, if they had in the past, if they're not doing it now, and they've dropped the ball, that they're still the thin line there, and they should make sure that regardless of what the social office is doing, they're doing their job right. If the social office, you know, changed their procedures, that should be part of the investigation.
Simple reform will solve this problem in the
future. No more state dinners.
Just ask to see the invitation. That's all they needed to do. Just ask, can I see your invitation?
Wristbands.
They knew that they did not have an invitation. And I must say, question whether someone who was not a cute blonde in a sari could have sashayed past. The Secret Service knew that they were not on the list and assumed that they would be caught by the next checkpoint.
Right. Wristbands would work too. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to do this. But there is something kind of bizarre how a reality show wannabes have now really turned the White House into its own version of a reality show, and we've all become so fascinated with this, and that the White House has had to spend time again, you know, deflecting questions.
But now, what about Desiree Rogers and the fact that the White House social secretary declined to appear?
Well, this is the executive privilege argument. And, you know, it seems to me we've had a lot of court cases going back to the Watergate tapes about this stuff. It involved the Paula Jones case and a lot of things. Executive privilege comes up. I think this is probably an area where the White House should have said, hey, we'll give you this one. We're not going to go to the Constitution on keeping our social secretary out of the line of fire on Capitol Hill.
David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine. Melinda Henneberger, Editor-in-Chief of PoliticsDaily.com. Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard, whose most recent book is titled The Persecution of Sarah Palin. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.